This is a recording of the Economic Policy Institute conference call on Thursday, October 13th, 2011, at 12 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you'd like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the call over to Doug Hall.
Good morning and or afternoon. I'm Doug Hall, Director of EARN, which is the Economic Analysis and Research Network at the Economic Policy Institute. EARN is a network of 57 state partners in 43 states. Thank you all for joining today's press call, highlighting the release of a new paper by labor economists at the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley. The paper is The Wrong Target, Public Sector Unions, and State Budget Deficits. We will hear today from Dr. Sylvia Allegretto, economist and deputy chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at UC Berkeley and a research associate here at EPI, and also from Amy Hanauer, executive director of Policy Matters Ohio, the Ohio EARN partner, before opening the lines for questions. This paper comes at a critical time when public sector workers are being demonized in state houses across the nation, scapegoats for a deep and persistent state fiscal crisis that resulted from the most significant economic collapse this country has seen since the Great Depression of the 1930s. State budget shortfalls during the recession and recovery period have dwarfed previous recessions. During the worst year of the last recession, shortfalls hit $80 billion. We are currently in the midst of the fourth year of shortfalls exceeding $100 billion, capped by a nearly $200 billion shortfall in fiscal year 2010. This paper clarifies the real causes of the state fiscal crisis. This is important first and foremost because finding and pursuing solutions to the fiscal and economic challenges we face first requires an accurate diagnosis of the problem. American workers in both the public and private sectors are currently paying a high price for prevailing misdiagnoses. The best way to continue improving state fiscal situations is to focus on the ongoing jobs crisis. And now I'm going to turn it over to Sylvia Allegretto, who will summarize the paper. After Sylvia speaks, we will hear from Amy, who will provide an overview of what this all looks like on the ground in the state of Ohio. So take it away, Sylvia.
Thanks, Doug. Well, the paper basically has one main point, and that is that no matter how you measure it, the housing bubble and the subsequent Great Recession caused the large state budget deficits, and not public sector workers or their unions. So what the paper does up front is really show a lot of data because, first and foremost, if public sector workers and their unions were to blame for these large gaps, at the very least one would expect to see some large and significant change in the public sector, something to do with the public sector prior, just prior to the bust. But the data do not bear such change. So we first look at and if you have the paper in front of you, you could actually follow me. I'm going to first talk about figure two because we want to go through some employment numbers. If we look at state and local government employment, it has been fairly steady for decades. Figure two looks at state and local government workers as a share of the total workforce. And this was calculated using BLS data. It's called the current employment statistics. And those are the jobs numbers that come out the first Friday of every month that we talk about. So if we use this tried and true data set from BLS, the CES shows that basically state and local government workers as a share of the total workforce has been hovering around 14.5% since 1979. We can also analyze state and government workers per 1,000 residents, and also using the CES data along with population counts from the U.S. Census, we see in Figure 3 that state and local government workers as per 1,000 residents has hovered around 61 to 64 per 1,000 since 1990. So again, there's no significant change there. We can look further into these data and see in Figure 4 that actually when we look at the 10 states with the lowest union density, they actually have a higher rate of state and local government employees per 1,000 residents than the 10 states with the highest union density. And that is documented in Figure 4. So we don't see any big jumps in this idea that we hear a lot of people talking about, overbloated public sector worker and these huge increases in public sector workers that one may have you think is going on just doesn't bear itself out in the data. So another item issue that we look at is what about the cost of employing public sector workers? And again, we go back to Bureau of Labor Statistics data. It's called the ECEC data, and that data is actually the cost of employing a worker. And these data are good because they're broken down by the private sector and the public sector. And we see from 2004 to 2009, we look at fourth quarter 2004, fourth quarter 2009, the actual cost of employing a worker in the private sector increased by 14.7%, while it increased by much lesser 12.6%. in the public sector. A little bit more on compensation. We see that there's a multitude of research that has recently been done by myself and also Jeff Keefe from Rutgers and John Schmidt from the economic from a DC think tank, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. There's been a lot of these papers put out by the states that show when you do an apples to apples comparison of public sector workers, the public sector workers are indeed not overcompensated. Unions simply provide a channel for the public sector workers in which the compensation package, wages and benefits, are negotiated. In general, the body of research has shown that the public sector workers, compared to private sector, their private sector counterparts, receive less in wages but more in benefits compared to private sector workers. So in some states, the benefit premium makes up for the lost wages. In other states, it doesn't. But when we look at total compensation total compensation is compared, government sector workers are not overcompensated compared to their private sector counterparts. We see this over and over in many of these, this research that's been done. So it certainly doesn't seem that government workers or their unions are the cause of these huge holes blown into state budgets. But we actually go further in this paper, and we go further and build on a piece that was done by a guy named John Sides, and Sides used regression analysis. And if we look at table one, we basically replicate what Sides showed. And specification one there, simply takes state budget deficits and it runs public sector unions, a regression analysis with public sector unions. And I don't want to get real technical here, and if you have questions, we can go further into this. But basically, that first regression shows that it does look like public sector unions contribute to state budget deficits. That coefficient that is 0.245 says basically that a 10% increase in public sector union density contributes 0.2% towards state budget deficits. And the star just shows that it looks like it's actually significant in a statistical way. But basically, we build on this model and simply throw in, along with the public sector union density, we throw in house price declines. Because given we had significant house price declines, we had an $8 trillion bursting housing bubble, it seems reasonable that we have to look, by states to see what role the housing bust has played in these state budget gaps. So the second specification basically shows that the coefficient on public sector union density, the 0.11, it becomes much smaller. It's basically halved from the first regression, and it's no longer statistically significant, meaning it can't be thought of as being different than zero in a statistical sense. But the house price decline, it's a large and extremely significant, very highly significant, 0.56. So, and the third regression just adds in some union strength variables, whether it's a right to work state, if you can actually go on strike and stuff. So we were even going further to say maybe it's not just union density, but union strength that is playing out here. But it's not the case. We see that the coefficients are almost exactly the same when you add in the strength variables. So in short, what this is showing is that it is not public sector union density that has anything to do with the public, the state budget deficits. It is simply the implosion of the housing bubble and the subsequent Great Recession that caused these huge gaps in the state budgets. So basically what happened is house price declines led us into the Great Recession, and given that the Great Recession took hold, we saw that state revenues plummeted as homeowners lost their homes, workers lost their jobs, and business activity contracted. At the same time, there was an increase in the demand for government safety nets and services to those in need. And, you know, quite frankly, this is what should happen if we have a responsive and responsible government. So simply put, the Great Recession is what is to blame for these deficits at state levels and not public sector unions or public sector union density or public sector workers. And so after Amy speaks, my co-authors, Ken and Laurel, are also on the line, and then we can take some questions.
Thanks so much, Sylvia. My name is Amy Hennauer again, and I'm the Executive Director of Policy Matters Ohio, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit policy research institute with offices in Cleveland and Columbus, and you can find us on the web at policymattersohio.org. You know, this was a great report because it really just brings a lot of insight to the fights that have been happening in states like Ohio, and I think as most of you on the call probably know, Ohio passed Senate Bill 5 last spring, and it sharply curtails collective bargaining. It eliminates the right to strike. It eliminates binding arbitration as a way of resolving impasses, and it imposes state mandates for how municipalities and school districts can compensate and retain staff. By on November 8th, Ohio voters have a chance to ratify or turn back these sweeping changes. So what's funny is that a lot of the main reasons given for these changes were exactly the things that Allegretto and her co-authors found were not relevant. So the main reasons given for these changes were that public workers are paid too much and that public budgets were too strained. And just this week, the spokesperson for the effort acknowledged that collective bargaining actually helps Ohio communities, but said getting rid of it was still needed because of the strains in the budgets. And so I think that this new research really shows how flawed the arguments are. You know, as Sylvia just said, these economists found that revenue plummeted not because of public compensation, but because of the disastrous housing market and the deregulation of that market. In Ohio, I would also add that the tax-cutting agenda that we've had here, which stripped about $2 billion out of the state budget annually since 2005, also played a huge role. And both of these policy choices really stem from excessive deference to a right-wing agenda of deregulating, of tax cutting. And I think that getting rid of bargaining rights in many ways is an extension of that agenda and therefore may be likely to worsen the problem. You know, as Sylvia mentioned, I think they go on to find that public employment has not grown as a portion of the workforce or population, that states with more public unions have fewer public workers per capita or at least about the same, and that compensation as a share of public spending has declined, and that public workers are actually paid less than similarly educated private workers. The study, I think, really drives a stake into the heart of the main arguments for reducing public worker rights in Ohio and other states. And I think it adds to a growing body of research that really finds many of the same things. And I just wanted to quote quickly from one line of the conclusion, which I found particularly compelling, which is that solutions that focus on cutting state and local budgets can be expected to further weaken the economy. So I think in sum, this is a really useful addition to the debate in Ohio. I hope that it's heeded by Ohio policymakers and by Ohio voters in November who have a chance to decide whether or not to allow this law to go into effect. And I'm happy to take any questions about other research on Ohio or what's going on in the Ohio collective bargaining debate. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Sylvia and Amy. And now we open it up to questions. So our operator, Ginny, if you have questions queued up, we are here to take them.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key. That's star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Marcia Baker with EIR News.
Thank you. I agree completely with what your thesis, and I'm sure the documentation, which I haven't seen, proves it 1,000 times over. I have a specific question for Amy from Ohio, but in general for anyone, including Doug Hall. One thing you cite, it's just twofold and simple. One thing you cite You're rightly calling about the Great Recession. I think we could call it the Great Depression. I think it's only beginning. But it was inclusive of the horrible housing mortgage debacle. But that was like one of a series of bubbles of the last 40 years where we had kind of casino investment economics instead of steel mills and farms and revenue for cities and states. So that said, there is an initiative to address that and not just cut ourselves to death, which is the cutting is going on in Europe on a nationwide basis, you know, the transatlantic orientation to austerity like crazy. There's an initiative to restore the Glass-Steagall principle that was put in 1933, where you end the speculative casino economics and go for credit generation, emergency grants to towns, you know, like Harrisburg or any town in the country, and then vastly expand the workforce and the revenue base. And that bill is H.R. 1489. Marcy Kaptur from Ohio filed it last April. It has 46 signatories now. Would you comment on going to the root cause? Because I think your idea of scapegoating public the wrongfulness of scapegoating public sector workers is completely true.
Right. Thanks for that question. You know, I can't comment on this particular piece of legislation, but what I can say is that there has been a real disinvestment in the infrastructure of Ohio, and there's been a real failure by in the American infrastructure in general, and certainly in Ohio, to provide the kind of energy efficiency that we need to move forward as a nation. So whether it's exactly the investments that are part of the bill that you describe, or more generally, I think it's really clear that we need substantial public investment and substantial public hiring, which would not only restore demand and stimulate the economy, but could take care of a number of public problems that have been too little invested in Ohio and around the country, from early childhood education to building retrofits and energy efficiency to production of renewable energy to restoration of our infrastructure to transportation. So I appreciate the question and think that that is probably generally the kind of approach that would be helpful.
Yeah, I just I can comment on you first mentioned austerity, and austerity is getting us exactly what you would expect, which is very slow growth. We're just above the zero indicator on growth, and also very weak employment growth, which won't move the needle on unemployment very quickly. We're stuck at about 9%. We have been for a very long time, and these austerity measures that are, you know, basically every month we're losing 30 to 40,000 state and local workers in the U.S. are going to help to keep us at this level. Commenting on the Glass-Steagall Act, there is no doubt that that's one policy. We have to put that back. It's basically, you know, a firewall between commercial banks and, as you kind of mentioned, the investment or the casino-like banks. And when that was tore down and you basically then had one big casino where you didn't have your kind of commercial banks that are supposed to basically allocate money to most efficient resources, instead we banks and financial institutes came up with all kinds of, you know, different types of mortgage and different types of financial instruments to make money off of money instead of making things. So yes, you know, reestablishing the Glass-Steagall Act in a very strong way would really help, I think.
Our next question comes from David Mober with In These Times.
Yeah, but if I may, two questions. One sort of following up on the first question, and that is, I wondered what advice you would offer to governors facing deficits in their budgets if they are not able to get more federal aid than looks like it will be coming. Would you recommend tax increases or some other strategy? And that second question had to do with whether you had any explanation for why there seemed to be no correlation between, or perhaps even an inverse correlation between unionization and the level of public employment.
This is Ken Jacobs. Just to answer your first question, we did some work independently looking at the question of what are the impacts of various strategies to close budget gaps on the economy and on employment. Because anything that you do to close the budget gap, either cutting spending or raising taxes, will have a depressing effect on the economy. But what we found was that programs like Medicaid, which bring in federal matching dollars, have a high multiplier, that the negative impacts on the economy of cutting those health and human services and social programs, not just counting the negative impacts on the people who would affect them, who would be affected by them, far outstrip the negative impacts of raising taxes. Lower income people spend more of their money and spend more of it in the local economy. And so, in general, in terms of dealing with the budget, solving the budget problems while avoiding the strongest negative impacts on economic growth, that increasing revenues through closing corporate tax loopholes, raising taxes on the higher income families, is much more preferable to cutting programs that have a bigger multiplier in the economy.
Yeah, and I would also say that I know that there's no political will for this, but we really do need to have kind of a bailout package or federal aid to the states. That part of that is in Obama's package. I think it's too small, but any little bit would be helpful. Certainly, the jobs package that didn't get out of the Senate the other day would be helpful. Although I don't, again, think it's not so much a stimulus at this point, because I think it's way too small, but it is a package that is projected to create 2 million jobs, which is good news. That will help us, I think, from falling backwards, but it's not going to propel us forward to solely really the 11 to 12 million job shortfall that we have.
This is Amy Hanauer, and I'll just comment on that first question while I imagine Sylvia or Ken will comment on the second one. You know, from the perspective of Ohio, I can just tell you that we have pursued a tax-cutting agenda very, very aggressively in this state, so that corporations paid about 40% of the state and local budgets in the mid-70s, and they now pay less than 30% of the state and local budgets. Adding to that, in 2005, we put in place some tax changes that took $2 billion out of our state budget every year. Just this most recent budget further continued that tax-cutting approach. We give away $7 billion in tax breaks every year. It is a ridiculous strategy. Over and over and over again, we find policymakers, often from both parties, but certainly from the Republican Party, pursuing a tax cut agenda in the name of job growth. And as Ken pointed out, if it results in cutting of services and programs, it is not going to cause job growth. It's going to depress job growth. So we definitely think that there's plenty of room in the Ohio economy to raise additional revenue and go back to a tax structure that we had at a time when growth was actually much stronger and when we were investing in Ohio to a better degree than we are today.
And this is Doug at EPI. Just a couple of other things. Certainly, we've had some reference to the neglected infrastructure in this country. Certainly with historically low interest rates right now, anything that states can do to infuse some capital investment will help to get unemployed workers back on the job today, particularly construction workers, while also helping to lay the foundation for prosperity going forward, whether that's through things like highway maintenance or school reconstruction or investing in broadband, for example. Those are all things that can help to ensure prosperity in the out years, as well as get people back to work today.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Mark Gruenberg with Press Associates Union News.
I have a question, one each for Ms. Allegretto and one for Ms. Hanauer. For Ms. Allegretto, you mentioned that there's a 0.56 correlation between the housing price collapse and the state budget deficits. And you had mentioned a similar correlation, but lesser, with the state workers' salaries. Can you put this in practical terms that readers can understand? In other words, of every $56, say, in housing collapses, that produced what? And for Amy, in so many words, I'm going to quote an old Republican congressman. This is way back. He said, "Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up." You're facing, you've got the facts here, but there's going to be a $20 million at least PR campaign in favor of SB 5 from Karl Rove, and that's just for starters. How are you going to get around that?
Great. Okay. Sylvia, do you want to go first, or I'm happy to, whichever works better.
Yeah, I mean, the way to read the coefficient is basically, you know, it says that the effect of a one percentage point decline in house prices is attributed, on average, to a 0.56 percentage point increase in a state budget deficit. I don't have any type of numbers worked out as far as exactly, but I think, you know, the budget deficits are different for different states,
right.
So to talk in percentage terms makes more sense.
Okay, that was unclear, that's why.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
And so, Amy, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's always helpful to actually have the facts on your side, and, you know, the facts in the collective bargaining debate here in Ohio are that public sector workers are actually paid less than comparably educated private sector workers, that the state budget deficit is not due to public worker compensation, and that there's plenty of room to raise additional revenue to provide the services that we need in Ohio. But, you know, I also think that the stories and the emotions are somewhat on the side of restoring collective bargaining rights as well. You know, the question is sort of what kind of state do you want? And I think that Ohio historically was the kind of state where people could expect to move here and find a decent life, find decent employment, and maybe expect something better for their kids than what they got for themselves, and where I feel like government and the public sector and business and unions kind of worked together to weave out this life that was going to work for people. So businesses could expect to find highly qualified workers who were well educated in our public schools. You know, if we want to have the kind of state where businesses want to invest, where people want to live, where people can thrive, and where communities can work, we really do need to have a decent public sector. And so, you know, going away from giving Ohio workers a voice in describing how that public sector ought to function, I think gets away from that kind of community. And I'll just say, in terms of the advertising, you know, there's a funny story this week in Ohio because the proponents of collective bargaining, the people who want to retain the collective bargaining law that's been in effect here since 1983, had an ad on featuring a great-grandmother whose great-granddaughter would have died in a fire if the firefighters had not been able to arrive in a timely way and been well-trained and been able to rescue this little girl. Her name was Zoe. The opponents of getting rid of, the people who want to get rid of collective bargaining actually stole footage from this ad and portrayed this great-grandmother in conjunction with the point of view that she was actually speaking against. And so from an emotional perspective, I mean, if they can't get smarter about how they're going to spend their advertising dollars, that's not going to help them either, because it's just, you know, this ad has now been pulled from 30 stations in Ohio, you know, because they're twisting this great-grandmother's words and she's outraged. And I think that Ohioans, you know, they may expect that in political ads where you're going up against a politician, but to do that to a great-grandmother I think hasn't gone over particularly well in Ohio. So, you know, I think there's some optimism in the campaign here.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Adele Stain with ASL-CIO blog.
Hi, this is a question for Amy, and I just blogged about that ad yesterday. It's quite amazing. My question is more impressionistic, and I'm wondering if you're sort of our eyes and ears right now on the ground in Ohio, and I'm wondering if you can tell me if you think that the message of this report is beginning to filter out in the public debate in a way that's meaningful in Ohio. Are people willing to, I mean, do people understand the role of the housing crash, you know, and the role of the market crash in the state of their budgets and the tax cutting, or is it still, I mean, it's such a much more complicated argument to make than just, you know, pointing fingers at public employees and saying they're the fault of it.
Well, I mean, you know, Ohio voters generally do seem at this point in the polling to favor retaining collective bargaining rights by a small double-digit margin. There is an Occupy, you know, the Occupy Wall Street protests, I think, are having a little echo effect here in Ohio. So I think that people understand that they don't want the people who teach their kids and answer when they call 911 and, you know, defend their, you know, drive their buses. I think people don't want those workers to be devalued and to have, you know, I think people want, see the value of those workers and want them to be reasonably well compensated and have a voice in their workplaces. Whether people connect it to the housing crisis, you know, these are complicated issues. I think some people do and some don't.
Okay, thank you.
I think workers are finally getting the idea. You know, at first it seemed like the attack on public sector workers, it turned worker against worker. As, you know, the powers that be were saying, oh, you know, why should your taxpayer dollars be paying, you know, for these public sector workers? I think workers now are starting to understand, wait a minute, you know, I shouldn't be so angry that, you know, public sector workers have what is really the last, you know, bastion of a solid middle class quality job that has health care, that has retirement benefits. You know, private sector workers are now saying, I think more and more, why don't I have those things? And as the movement with the Wall Street movement and Occupy Wall Street and the information of what's really been going on in the last 30 years with inequality, with wealth inequality, that the slice of the growing pie for the very wealthy has exploded while it is shrinking for the rest of America's working class. So I think the idea of pitting worker against workers is being less successful these days. And the reason why is because I think they're starting to understand what public sector workers do. So as their libraries are closing, as parks are closing, as their kids' teachers are being laid off, as schools are closing, as school class size are getting larger, people are starting to understand public sector workers play a crucial role and a vital role in communities and make you know, they're what make you know, make it valuable and worthwhile to live in the communities where we live. And so once the cutting started, it didn't seem like it was maybe all that bad. It seemed like a good idea, although putting anybody in the unemployment line today is a big mistake. But now that it, you know, there just wasn't that much fat. You know, we're down to cutting basic services. And there are services that people want and that people value in their communities. So I think now, you know, they're really starting to understand what it means to cut this much and to cut this many public sector workers.
Thank you. Please press star 1 at any time to get into the question queue. Our next question comes from Louis Labrecue with the Bureau of National Affairs.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask Sylvia if you could repeat your explanation of the coefficient just one more time, but also just wanted to ask why so many governors, you know, even Democrats, have focused on public sector benefits and have identified, you know, gaps and funding problems and so on. Why do you suppose that has been happening?
Well, first, again, if you're having problems with this is on page 8 in the paper.
Okay.
You know, again, it's the coefficient is just simply saying a 1 percentage point decline in housing prices, you know, on average, for an average state, it's basically a 0.56 percentage point increase in a state's budget shortfall. So there is a direct, you know, a direct connection between housing price declines and increased budget shortfalls. And I should say that if you run these regressions with unemployment rates instead of housing declines, state unemployment rates, so capturing again the increase in unemployment, or if you run it with state decline in state GDP, gross domestic product per state, all of these variables, housing price declines, unemployment rates increasing, or the decline in state GDP, they all show the same outcome, basically, that it's basically the economy. Those are all capturing what happened in the economy, the implosion of the economy. So when in any of these regressions, the coefficient on public sector union density or the coefficients on the public sector strength variables that are in there, they're all very, very small, statistically insignificant. They're not distinguishable from zero. And in all of these regressions, it is the housing price decline, the unemployment rate, or the decline in state GDP that matters.
Okay. Thank you.
And just, Ken Jacobs again, and just in answer to the benefit costs, there's no question that healthcare costs have been rising. That's true in the public sector. That's true in the private sector. That's an issue that needs to be addressed, but it won't be solved simply cutting benefits shifts the cost. It doesn't solve the problem. In terms of the other place of focus, of course, has been on pensions, and we do have a serious underfunding of pension programs, which came about, again, due to the economic decline. It's a drop in stock market values. Solving that problem, a central part of it, is getting the economy going again. The overall underfunding comes out to 1.5% of state budgets if you look at, you know, amortizing it out over the 30 years that it'll be paid back. But employer contributions to pension funds have gone up in order to pay for the underfunding. But again, looking at the, when we look at this overall, what struck me is there is zero correlation between union density and level of underfunding of pension funds. And when we look at the rates that employers or that the public is paying in terms of the contribution rates toward pension funds, you see some non-union states like Louisiana with very high employer contribution rates and union states like Minnesota with very low employer contribution rates. It's not unionization or public sector unionization that's driving this. Again, some of it has to do with states that took pension holidays and didn't fund in good times is the key part. And the other piece, of course, is the economic decline.
Thank you very much.
To have your question answered now, please press star 1. Next, we have Mark Grunberg with Press Associates Union News.
One of the two questions that the previous caller asked got answered, but the other didn't. So I'm going to repeat it, and ask, which is why, despite the factual data, despite the impact of the recession, are so many governors, Democratic and Republican, still jumping on board the demonized public workers bandwagon? I mean, even in my old home state, Illinois, Governor Quinn has now reversed course and says we should not have collective bargaining for local workers. And he's just one example. And he's a Democrat.
Right. This is Amy Hanauer, and, you know, I usually do try to say, if you want to know why someone's doing something, ask them, not me, but, you know, I think that what we have seen over the last generation in Ohio and around the country is a real deference to a tax-cutting agenda. Then when you combine that with the deep recession, you ended up with state budgets that were constrained, that seem constrained, because we've cut taxes so much and then we've deregulated and allowed the economy to go off a cliff, so that revenues, even for the taxes that were intact, were lower than they were projected to be. And so for a particular governor right now looking at their state budget and not willing to change the tax structure, they feel like they have to do something. But the fact is that we can change those tax structures, and it can be very compatible with high growth, as we saw in previous times in our economy. And voters as a whole are very willing to have taxes increased, if they're increased in the right ways, to pay for the things that they value in their communities, from good schools to good roads to, you know, safe streets. So I think that would be my answer, is that governors just have relied so heavily on tax cutting and on big tax breaks for their largest campaign contributors that they don't see clear to a better way of doing things, or they're not willing to see clear to a better way of doing things.
It's political.
It seems quite opportunistic, certainly in many instances, that because in the way I talk about this paper a lot of times as we were writing was that it was the duh paper, like, wow, I mean, really? I mean, we have to write a paper to basically show that this implosion, you know, this $8 trillion housing bust that you know, was the impetus to the Great Recession, that to lose sight of that in this debate was pretty remarkable. Any more questions?
All right. It sounds like that's it. Thank you so much to everybody on the call. Thank you to Sylvia and Amy, Ken and Laurel, for all of the great work that you've done. If anybody on the line has follow-up questions, please direct them to UCB's Rebecca Graham at 510-642-9187, and her email is rgraham@berkeley.edu. Just one closing comment here. We've heard today that public sector workers are not responsible for the budget deficits that have crippled so many state governments. Instead, we know that really, as Sylvia has said so succinctly, it's the economy, duh. We need to fix the economy. We need to put American workers in every state back to work. And only then will we see state coffers begin to fill up with income tax revenues, with consumption-based revenues. And we need to turn our attention to the real problems rather than focusing on all these paper tigers. Thank you so much. And everybody, please have a great day.
Thank you, Doug.